can before 9. If we cannot, that's okay. We'll get together next week and the week after to continue work, but whatever we finish by today, I think, would be what's in the bill for the committee deadline next week. So we'll try to do as much as we can here today. And then other work that the commission does will be done by amendment because we had such a late start. So, and we can only go to 9 today. So, Senator Michelle, let's start with, I think, number 4.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, if I could ask representatives from the Department of Commerce, the State Patrol.
We just started. Yeah, started with 4.
And who else was involved in this?
State Retirement System.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Bergstrom to come to the table. Representative Smith and I just had a brief huddle on the side. We have an amendment, Mr. Okay. Chair, which has been prepared. It has been handed out. And the three parties at the table have come to an agreement to move this bill forward, and I'd like them to present it. And perhaps we'd start with you, Mr. Levasseur, just to give a brief introduction to the bill itself.
Let's start. Senator Michelle moves that Senate file, that the delete everything be adopted. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed,
aye.
Motion adopted.
Mr. Chair, my name is Gary Levasseur. I'm the Enforcement Director for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The bill you have in front of you today will address an issue of what retirement plan the sworn police officers who are going to be employed in the division, or excuse me, the department's insurance fraud unit will be assigned to. And we have come to an agreement with the State Patrol plan that the sworn officers, I'll try and summarize this, assigned to this program will be covered by the State Patrol plan until they reach the age of 60. Upon attainment of the age 60, they will revert to the MSRS general retirement plan. So try to keep it very short. If you have any questions about the unit, I can fill you in on that. But this unit has been was first, I think, addressed in the statutes 2.5 years ago or 3 years ago, and it's been slowly gathering speed and coming online, and this is one of the final steps.
How many people are we talking?
We're talking 5 to 8 people, Mr. Chair.
At maximum, it'll be 5 to 8?
That's what we anticipate, yes, Mr. Chair.
How many are current employees?
There is only one current employee right now.
Okay.
Matt. My name is Matt Hodapp. I'm on the State Retirement Board. I'm a state trooper. And the issue came up in that we're concerned about conserving the integrity of the 60 mandatory retirement that we have in our State Patrol plan. And the Department of Commerce was looking at hiring someone who has already attained that age. He's retired from another police agency and was already over the age of 60. So in trying to craft some language to allow for that so that they could get up off the ground and get running, what we came up with was what's before you now, which would still maintain that anyone within our State Patrol plan retire at age 60, but anyone like in the Commerce that was already over age 60 would go into our general plan. And we believe that would satisfy all the pension needs and the Department of Commerce as well.
Are these positions budgeted for or anticipated to be budgeted for? Or,
Mr. Chair, these positions are funded by an assessment on the insurance companies doing business in Minnesota. There's actually a formula in the statute that bases the assessment on a company's market share and their total premium dollars in Minnesota. So that's the source of funding for the entire unit.
And what? Apparently, there are some safety issues, or what are they? Are these people who are going to go out and deal in the field with? Well, but with violent people and stuff, or
the violent insurers? Yeah. You might want to explain that, Mr. Levasseur.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mousselles. These individuals will be sworn officers. They'll have the power of arrest. They'll have the ability to serve search warrants. They will be working on crimes related to insurance fraud. And from my experience, these crimes do involve people who have violent propensities. Gangs are frequently involved in insurance fraud. Various groups of individuals. It's not simply a victimless crime. You have everything from auto theft to potentially homicides. So you're dealing with individuals, and they are.
Okay. TRA is comfortable.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dave Bergstrom, the director of the State Retirement System. The policy issue of whether to include them or not is kind of up to you. What the amendment does is puts the participants in this program in the state patrol plan until age 60 and then moves them to the general employee's retirement plan. The one employee that is currently hired is in our general employee's retirement plan already.
How old is that person?
Mr. Chair, did you ask?
Oh, the current who is retired, the person who is retired.
The person who is actively employed now is, I believe, 61.
61, okay. Yeah. Sam Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bergstrom, then would, when the person retires, would they have a combined service? Is that it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. They would retire under a combined service law.
Because they wouldn't, Mr. Chair, they wouldn't be collecting their highway patrol pension at the same time they were working for the Department of Commerce.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct. They would have to terminate, then they would draw both. At the same time, start drawing both at the same time using the combined service law.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, is this, would that be a fair sum then? There wouldn't be a big boost because they were having the two. It would be comparable as if they were in one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the formula for the state patrol plan is 3% a year. The formula for the general employee's retirement plan is 1.7%. They would use the high five, the highest high five for both of those pieces.
And, Mr. Chair, would they be inclined to retire then on their fifth year? Retire?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the at age 60, they may be inclined to retire. I don't know that or not. The person who is there now is working and seems comfortable with it. I think it's become a little bit of a personal choice.
You know, it seems that the question really is, now there are obviously people on police plans who do desk jobs. You know, I know I'm wading into something here, but...
Short
meeting. Yeah, I know. Why? Give us again the reason why these particular employees are going to be faced with danger, and are they carrying weapons and things, or are they making a lot of phone calls?
Mr. Chair,
What I'm visualizing, and I'm not trivializing. I know this is serious, but you know, I just think of this high school kid that got arrested by the fraud units because he was doing fraud over the internet, and I thought, I wasn't sure how dangerous that arrest was.
Mr. Chair, these individuals will be doing white collar crime investigation, and I've spent many years in that area, and they will be doing both analysis of paper trails. And they'll also be doing the normal things that a peace officer does. They'll be, as I said, serving arrest warrants. They will be taking people into custody. They'll be booking them. They'll be testifying.
They'll physically be out in the field.
They will have physically be out in the field, and they'll have all the normal responsibilities of a peace officer.
And will they be carrying a weapon?
Yes, they will.
So this is a little more than being a tax auditor at the Department of Revenue.
Very much so, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, this unit was formed internally a couple of years ago, as I understand it, but it actually became law last year. Is that right?
It was funded last year.
It was funded last year. So this is kind of, we're behind the eight ball in that this police agency was already made or formed last year by the session, is funded wholly out of user fees, no tax dollars as I understand it, and so now it's just a matter of plugging them into the proper pension arena where they belong, proper pension plan.
Mr. Martin, I want Mr. Martin to ask a question.
Members, the question I have is, and just trying to sort out the implications of what you're proposing here. If you have a 61-year-old police officer goes out on a call or does whatever the duties are, is injured and cannot do police duties at 61, is covered by MSRS General, which requires a total and permanent disability eligibility requirement, what happens under your scenario here? I would read this that they would not have a disability benefit. They would be unable to do the law enforcement duty, but they would probably, if they can still do other employment, they're not qualified to get a disability benefit under the MSRS general plan. And I can see someone coming back in that circumstance 1, 5, 10 years from now saying, gee whiz, we didn't know. So I just wanted to lay that on the record and get your response.
Mr. Chair, the way this would work, if they are totally and permanently disabled, this is now assuming they're over age 60, they would then qualify for the disability coverage under the general plan. Whether they retire or disabled under the state patrol plan is not going to matter because their full retirement age is 55 and is identical to what their disability benefit would be anyway. Because they already qualify for an unreduced pension. So they would get the disability coverage from the general plan and get an amount equal to their retirement benefit using the 3% formula under the state patrol plan. Because there's no after a state patrol plan member is 55, the disability benefit's the same whether they retire or they go out on disability. I'm not sure if that addresses the question. That's how I would envision this working.
Okay, Senator Michelle moves that Senate File 1834 and House File 2080 be incorporated. That delete everything. All in favor? Does anybody want to testify on this? Anybody else? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion adopted. Let's do number 5, Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Burke.
Members, maybe the best place to start is to look at page 2 of the memo. One of the reservations that commission members may have is it's not clear just what the problem is here, and hence it's difficult to figure out what sort of remedies should be allowed in this proposed law. If you look at table 2 on the bottom, it's an overview of the actuarial work. And the most recent information we have is for 2003. Now, that's from the July 1, 2004 actuarial valuation. You'll notice that the funding ratio is 110%. It's unusual for a plan that's overfunded to be coming in with a bill that isn't designed to give relief. So it's unclear to me just what's happening here. I would assume that there is now available a January 1, 2005 valuation covering 2004. We have not seen it, though. Since we have a bill asking for relief, I would assume that there has been some noticeable change in the condition. So we're in a position where we're uncertain what the current situation is with this plan, and we also have no information showing what impact these proposed changes would have on the plan if they were, in fact, adopted. So the commission may wish to seek additional information about just what the problem is here and just what tools are needed. What the bill does is three things, as indicated in the executive summary there. The first thing it's doing is extending the amortization date from 2010 to 2031. Now, that's of relevance for a plan that has an unfunded liability. given the most recent information we have there, this plan doesn't have an unfunded liability. An additional issue with that is the extent of that amortization date extension. If this plan were to go into a condition where it has an unfunded, it's something that's happening quite new. It's not a situation where we have a plan that's been running on unfunded liabilities for many years, and the problem's been getting worse and worse. So the problem is not likely to be very severe, and pushing it out for that long seems like it may be overkill. The second part of that same change is that the bill would tie any further changes in that amortization date to any changes in para-general. Now, the para-general date is set in law at 2031, and it will not change unless the legislature goes in and actually revises that law for para-general. Presumably, the legislature would do that to address a problem that para-general is having, and there doesn't seem to be any reason to have a mechanism that would automatically change the Bloomington fire date just because the legislature was addressing the problem with para-general. So that the second part of that amortization date proposal is quite questionable. The next thing it's doing is changing the interest rate. It's increasing it from 5% to 6%. That general change would lower the liabilities of the plan because the actuary would be assuming that the assets of the plan are growing at a quicker rate, and hence we're getting more assets generated from investment return prior to payout rather than contribution. So that change would be helpful if a plan needed it, but there is a question of whether the plan actually needs it. The final change is the adoption of an actuarial value methodology that's currently used by Minneapolis Relief Associations with a minor change. Minneapolis Relief Associations use cost plus realized gain plus a 3-year average of past unrealized gains or losses. This proposal would use a 5-year average of the past gains or losses for that portion of it. Now, a problem with that approach is that I question whether that Minneapolis model is a good one, and I question whether it really has much of a smoothing impact. A problem with that particular approach is that it's relying on double counting of assets. If the investment managers of the plan were to sell the assets to recognize a gain, that's going to show up in the recognized gain portion of the computation. But if the pension fund held those assets for a few years, it's likely it would also show up as part of the past unrecognized gains. So these assets would be counted first as recognized gains and would also slip into the computation as past unrecognized gains. And this double counting seems to me likely to destabilize rather than to stabilize. So if the commission decides that there is some need for some sort of asset smoothing methodology, that Minneapolis model may not be the one the commission wishes to use. Final comment I would make is that this relief association over the last 10 years has had considerable investment problems. The investment returns have been lower, considerably lower than SBI and some of the other major plans, and the investment returns have also been less stable. So to an extent, what this bill before you is doing is dealing with some symptoms rather than some underlying causes. And I would suggest to you that some improvements in the Bloomington investment program would help to remedy any problems they have here. If they had higher investment returns, they would have more assets. And with more assets, they would have more negative amortization to cover any contribution requirements that are falling on the city. It would also be less likely that there would arise situations where there would be an unfunded liability to amortize. The other thing is that the returns of this association seem to be less stable. There's more variability, and hence the desire for some sort of asset smoothing methodology. Perhaps it would be worthwhile addressing the core problem there, which seems to be a problem of diversification within the fund. So this is a fairly complex problem that you're presented with, and it is somewhat difficult to figure out just what changes are needed and what the impact of those changes will be.
Mr. Bernardson.
Chair Pogemiller, members of the Joint Pension Commission, my name is Mark Bernardson, City Manager, City of Bloomington, and I appreciate very much the time you're taking this morning to consider the bill of Senate File 2038. Senator Michelle is chief author, and House File 2173. Representative Larson is chief author. The Bloomington Fire Relief Association achieved its full funding in 1989 and has been fully funded in all but one of the last 14 years. 2002 was a bellwether year. Unfortunately, when many funds saw decreases in their performance, and that it is the same year that Bloomington, which had been about 20% invested in SBI, shifted to 75% investment in SBI. And so I know that the Pension Commission staff has encouraged us to work on the investment portfolio, and we think we have done that by shifting it over. I don't want to go into the nuances, but I think originally Bloomington Fire Relief Association during the 80s and early 90s did outperform SBI, but SBI did have a change in the mid-90s, and it took us a while to see the wisdom of that, but as I indicated, we have shifted over. The objective that we are looking for, we do not have a current problem per se, but we are trying to be proactive. We are trying to smooth things out, and we are trying to take an approach that what happened to us in 2002 when we did have a dip, that we are able to address that prospectively and move that out over several years. We've been, we feel, a good manager and steward of the assets and the pension fund. But that we are looking to make sure that we are taking proactive action to make this happen. As Mr. Burrick indicated, there are three items to this. One is the full funding date, the second is the interest rate assumption, and the third is asset smoothing. And frankly, we would like to, they had suggested the 214 amendment to delete the asset smoothing, and we would like to withdraw or delete the asset smoothing at this time. We think that there is work needed in that regard to better understand the impacts of that. As far as the other two items, presently 2010 is the full funding date for some of the funds. As indicated, PERA has moved theirs out to 2031. We took the 2031 approach and linking it to PERAs more as what was traditional in Minnesota as far as having an established date. The Pension Commission staff has suggested in their report that a rolling average may be more appropriate than a fixed 2031 date. If that is an approach that they feel is appropriate as far as rolling average, I think we would be willing to go along with that. However, we would strongly suggest a 20-year rolling average instead of a 10-year rolling average for this bill and use that as a model for other local funds as you move forward. One of the reasons for the 20-year rolling average is this fund generally, in order for somebody to qualify and needs 20 years, we would expect that if we were in the future ever to do anything with this fund, you'd have 20 years prospectively of active members in it, and I think that would be an appropriate time. The second item would be the interest rate. I think you've seen in your materials that interest rate assumptions range from 5% to 8.5%. There are several funds at the upper end of 8.5%. We, however, do not feel that we want to go that strongly. It does help our performance in our actuarial study, but we would recommend at this point only going to 6%, which is conservative and well below what our long-term interest rate achievement has been. We have one other objective in addition to smoothing is that this is a fairly large fund, and we don't want to continue with lower rate interest assumptions particularly, but also with the 2010 funding date, which the closer you get to that 2010 funding date, the more of a whipsaw you're on if you happen to go underfunded. But also, once you hit the 2010 date, every year you have to make up that deficit, and it has the possibility of making this more and more positively funded longer term if you get those kind of spikes. And so we are looking for something that keeps the fund positively funded long term and yet not too positively funded. As such, ultimately, the Bloomington City, or the City of Bloomington, is fully responsible for the funding of this pension fund, and await any questions that you may have.
Okay, do the anybody else want to testify?
Just set any precedence for other volunteer firefighters?
Chair Pokemiller, I think there's one question. We do have the 2004 report, and we had increased the positive funding ratio from, I think it was a 110% to 115%. So we are positively
115?
Yes.
Has the staff seen that? Let's make sure the staff has that. Mr. Burke or Mr. Martin, could you explain how Bloomington is the same or different from what we consider volunteer firefighter funds?
Members, Bloomington is generally considered to be a volunteer fire plan, but it sort of falls somewhere in between. In terms of the benefits, it's the only volunteer fire plan where the benefits that individuals are receiving is tied to an active duty salary. It's tied to
a full-time fire department.
Actually, it's tied to the police officer's salary, a Bloomington police officer's salary. It's the benefit is based on that, and it's a plan that was established, I think, in 1958 on that. 58 on that basis.
So we would consider this kind of a full-time fire department. It's not like in the smaller towns where. What's it like?
I would disagree with you.
Okay, why don't you describe it?
I happen to be a volunteer firefighter for nine years in Golden Valley back in the mid-70s to the mid-80s. It operates very much like the small town and the suburban ones, in that we do not have traditionally people in the stations on a full-time basis, but people respond to fire calls as they come up. The two components in the smaller communities, you may or may not have a pay-per-call compensation, and you may have a small pension. The only difference there is as you move into the suburbans, you generally have a higher per-call pay, because of the call load, you generally have a more generous pension. In Bloomington's particular case, while we do have a different type of pension setup, the per-call pay is substantially below the per-call pay of most of the suburban departments, probably in the range of half of the average per-call pay. But it, I think, in all respects, very much resembles the traditional volunteer model you find in the suburban area.
So, Mr. Chairman, what are they paid per call then?
I think right now, and I haven't looked it up, but I think it's about $4. And I think the average in the metro area is probably between $7 and $10 per call.
Are there other volunteer departments that have a pension plan like this that is based on – this is the only one like this?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Chair Pogemiller, this, as we said, it was a special law back, I think, in 58, and it really does fall between the career police and fire funds and the volunteer funds. And so we find ourselves in a unique position because of what was done almost 50 years ago. But in a way, it is somewhat like some of the suburban volunteer funds that have a monthly benefit. It's just that the basis of that monthly pension benefit for Bloomington is set against the patrol officer's salary as opposed to the other pension benefits in the other volunteer departments in the suburban area, which are usually a monthly amount based on years of service.
Is there an employee group here that would have reviewed this? Or
we've been working with the chief, and the chief has been working with the Relief Association, and they would support these changes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Michelle.
I would move the 214 amendment, which would put it into the form that Mr. Bernardson has suggested, so we can then focus on the amortization date and the interest rate. And so we get rid of the language on the smoothing.
Senator Michelle moves 214, takes out the change in the asset methodology. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. How about the rolling average?
Chair Pogemiller, members of the commission, again, we tried to model it after what was traditionally done. If the commission would feel it appropriate, we would recommend, I think it is the one of the alternatives. I think it is the 211 amendment.
Okay, I think we got it. Is it 211?
Yeah.
Senator Michelle moves to 211, but you would like it 20 years.
Correct.
All right, Mr. Chairman, to make it 20 years, you would need a page and line amendment. On the 211 amendment, page 1, line 10, delete 10 and insert 20.
Okay, Senator Michelle incorporates that. Members understand? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, aye. Motion adopted. Okay, then I think any other of those amendments the staff is suggesting is necessary at this point?
I have a question, Senator Mr. Chair. What's the need for the non-severability provision, section 4 of the bill?
Chair Pogemiller, Senator Betzold, if you could direct me to the page on that.
If you look at the bill.
Right, I'm on the bill.
The last page of the packet, section 4, is page 9, lines 9 to 14.
Right, I have that now. I have to say this goes more to reviser language, and I'm not fully up to speed on what that is. Perhaps joint pension staff could address that.
We don't think it's needed. Staff doesn't think it's needed.
I'll move the 208 amendment then. That removes this non-severability language.
Betzel moves 208. Senator Michelle, okay?
It's fine.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Do we need some local approval language? Did we just strike the local approval language?
No,
so all that amendment did was took the severability phrase out. The local approval is still there.
Okay.
Okay. Staff, any of these other amendments that you'd like us to consider?
Mr. Chairman, that certainly is up to the commission. The commission has taken action on the actuarial value of assets issue, which would be the 214 or 215. You selected 214. You addressed the amortization date. The only other issue is the interest rate issues, which would be the 212, 213. If the commission has any interest in dealing with those.
Seems like this one seems reasonable to leave it there. Okay. Senator, I mean, my apology, Representative Osmond.
I'd like to find out what on page 3 there's some language. I'm trying to learn how to read some of these things, and I'm wondering what that language is about. Why is that changed there? Because it mentions more than just the Bloomington Fire Department.
Mr. Chairman, page 3 of the bill?
Of the bill. Right.
Chair
Mr. Chairman, that language is there simply to avoid changing the amortization date for Fairmont Police, Minneapolis Fire, and Minneapolis Police. So those three associations remain at 2010, and the Bloomington Fire Relief Association would have changed, but that language has been revised by one of the amendments that's been adopted.
All right. Thank you.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Bernardson, will you clarify why you brought this legislation to us?
Chair Pogemiller, Representative Murphy. We did experience 1 year in which we had an unfunded liability, and that created quite a spike, and that's something that rolled back onto our tax. Property tax needs, and so what we're trying to do is, as I indicated, really two things: smooth things out over a longer period of time. Because the closer we get to the 2010 fully funding date, if we do that, really creates a spike. And once we pass 2010, under the current law, every year we'd have to make up that full deficit.
Okay.
This spreads that out over, as the amendment would propose, 20 years. And secondly, we are concerned that. This would create too positive a funding position if we have some dips in that. Plus, the interest rate does help us in that regard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Mr. Burke, in his introductory remarks, said that this really was dealing with the symptoms and not the core. Did you agree with that, or do you think this will address the core?
Senator Pogemiller, Representative Murphy, we could probably have a long discussion on that, and since I just saw this information yesterday, I was trying to put together about a 25-year history of SBI and the Bloomington Fire Relief Association, the four part of which Bloomington Fire Relief Association and its management were doing better than SBI. SBI turned the table, but I think ultimately we moved from 20% in SBI up to 75% to SBI, so I think We have been following the guidance that the staff has been looking for, and I think prospectively our returns will be more in line with what SBI has.
And Senator Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, you agree with that?
I do.
Mr. Chair.
On the brevity, that's the difference between the House and the Senate floors last night. We were just real brief. Senator Michelle moves that Senate File 2038, House File 2173, as amended, be incorporated. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody here that's not normally here for any of these bills that are on the agenda? No. Okay. Then we're gonna do number. Somebody had their hand up. What bill are you here for? That's the one I was just gonna take up. Come on up. This is a request by the Department of Corrections, and we'll pass out an amendment. Mr. Martin, this for members who have been on mission, this one will sound familiar, kind of, or this whole issue will sound familiar. Mr. Martin?
Members, this relates to the MSRS correctional plan. That's the special quasi-public safety type plan for several of the various positions at the various correctional facilities and the St. Peter's Security Hospital and a couple other facilities run by Human Services. The bill deals with the broad topic of who should and should not be in the pension plan. What the bill does is it would require Corrections and Human Services to create a procedure for proposing to the legislature inclusions and subtractions from the MSRS plan. So it delegates or designates, mandates the departments to create a procedure and to periodically submit to the legislature the proposed new inclusions or any exclusions from the membership of the correctional plan. The correctional plan was set up in 1973. It initially covered only correctional guards and security counselors at the security hospital. It was expanded in 1974 to include teachers, tradesmen, and some maintenance personnel. Since then, especially in 1996, it was substantially increased and covers a number of different employment classifications. The issue with the plan is always making sure that the folks who have the right characteristics are in the plan.
I think the amendment may not quite be right. It's page 2, line 7, I think.
Senator, the last page of the bill.
This page, okay.
It's drawn to the actual bill.
Okay, so it's drawn to the last page, okay.
Members, this is a fairly late introduction. We have a internet version of the Senate File 2139 on as the last page. And we did draw the amendment on. The amendment would reduce the four-part determination procedure down to two parts. It would do away with items 3 and 4. So this would be on page 2, lines 12 through 15, it would do away with those two parts.
Okay, so members, what this does is it kind of gives the department the moral authority to have a process whereby they can make recommendations to us if they want to move some individuals or job classifications, I guess you'd say. And as originally drafted, there was a concern that we overstated, I guess. So what's the argument for taking out this language? Other than I know that the employee groups wanted it out, but which is fine, but maybe explain just so we have a better sense of that
what that issue is there.
Senator Pogamiller, Commission members, I'm Chris Bray, Assistant Commissioner at the DOC. With me is Ruth Dahl, Assistant Director of Human Resources, and Sherry McMurray, who will speak on behalf of the Department of Human Services. You're correct. Our understanding is that the employee groups had a problem with that language, and I think they felt like they hadn't seen that language before in statute. And this is
kind of the criteria you're actually using, though.
We primarily use the 75% of the person's time in direct contact with inmates or patients, regularly engaged in rehabilitation, treatment, custody, et cetera. I think the underlying understanding is that there is a significant physical hazard, but I don't know that that has ever been delineated this clearly, so we haven't had discussion with them. We didn't include this. This isn't our language.
Okay. Correct, but the commission has kind of been using that language over the years. So I think even though I think we should delete the language, I don't think anybody should be under the delusion that the commission isn't thinking about that language.
And I would just state we don't.
Because when we did this, when we went through these, it seems to me we had numbers of these that we considered a couple of years ago. We actually went through and selectively picked ones. And this was kind of the criteria the commission was using, even though it may not be explicit. I'm just trying to make sure the employee groups are not believing that somehow there's a backtracking here. And I'm supporting taking the language out. So, matter of fact, Senator Bedsole moves the 229. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. This language has not been in statute.
Correct.
And we oppose putting it into statute, which we believe would change significantly. But it is, you are correct in saying that the questions on the form that's used by the Department of Corrections contains these two questions. But
okay.
It delineates there's a major difference for us with asking those questions on the form as compared to having this language in statute.
Okay. And I think it's fair to say that the commission has had that in mind as it was talking about these particular classifications. So, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Then I don't think there's any controversy over this now.
No.
Representative Murphy moves that Senate file 2139, House file XXX be incorporated. Anybody else want to testify? I think everybody's ready to go here in the departments.
Correct.
Okay. This was a request by the executive agency. So.
It's a good idea, Mr. Chair.
On the Murphy motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All
aye.
Opposed, motion adopted. Okay, Bedsole, should we do your Blaine?
Yes.
Number three? Yeah, no, they are in my office. So. Mr. Martin?
Members, the bill, Senate file 235,
number three, number
file 375, it's number three on your tab, would expand the PERA police and fire membership to include certain civilian employees who are also combination firefighters in either the city of Blaine or Mounds View or Spring Lake Park. This is a proposal from the Blaine Mounds View Spring Lake Park Fire Department. It's a nonprofit firefighting corporation that serves those three communities, and apparently it would be an attempt by that fire department to increase the number of available firefighters at times when they have difficulty obtaining firefighters. The chief of the fire department is here. And may want to talk about what the intent of the proposal is. We do have one technical amendment, which the bill does two things. It incorporates and it adds to PERA police and fire membership this combination civilian firefighter positions. It also resets or modifies to some degree the disability benefit eligibility provisions. The primary thrust of the technical amendment is to put those two things in their proper spot, keep the membership stuff separate from the disability benefit part, and put each in the right part of PERA police and fire statute.
Bedsole moves the 104. Yep. Review the 104.
Mr. Chairman, yes, my understanding there needs to be a delete of line 25 and 26 on that technical amendment, though. In working with Mrs. Vanek, she suggested that.
Ms. Vanek seems to think that's... What page is that, Ms. Vanek?
Mr. Chair, members, Mary Vanek, para-director. Page 1, lines 25 and 26 aren't necessary. The language in the bill sets forth the process for determining whether or not they can be excluded from Social Security.
Okay, so Bedsold incorporates that change.
Right.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. Mr. Zickman.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission, Niall Zickman. I'm the fire chief for the Spring Lake Park Blaine Mounds View Fire Department. The bill we're proposing before you today works to help solve our staffing problem at the department. The fire department currently is serving the fifth largest population in the state of Minnesota. It's a primarily a volunteer fire department. In 3 to 5 years, with the growth that's going on in the city, it's estimated we'll be serving the third largest population in the state of Minnesota, right behind Minneapolis and St. Paul. We have one development right now with 5,200 homes, the Lakes development. As we try and staff that fire department during the day, we're experiencing the same problem that's occurring statewide and nationwide, is daytime availability of volunteers. In the past 5 years, despite extensive recruiting efforts, we've actually declined our number of daytime volunteers. This is an attempt to use a proven method of using pensions to recruit and retain additional firefighters, and those firefighters would be defined as those coming from the three cities. The reason I like those people is they're around 90-95% of the time. The requirements, and I would like to describe that I would view these as full-time firefighters, they would go to every single fire call, every training session, meet all of our requirements as if I just hired them as career firefighters. They will have to comply with all of the same requirements. You couldn't tell the difference if they're on the scene, if they're in PNF, if they're not in PNF, because they have no choice. They'll have to comply. The issue is, despite the growth that I've described to you, in the past 10 years, my call volume has not increased. In fact, it's actually decreased. Despite enormous growth, we've had a decrease in call volume. These individuals are needed 2 to 4 times a week. It's simply not prudent on our part and the taxpayers' part to hire a traditional career firefighter that would, you know, literally be inactive 36 to 38 hours a week. So we're just trying to recognize what's going on in the suburban communities. We need firefighters. We're looking to find a new model, if you will. These individuals will go to every call. They will go to every training session. In fact, I would argue they'll go to more training than they will to fire calls because of our call volume. The bill does a couple things. We've worked with the PRA executive staff in putting for the first time in some definition of what a firefighter is and clarifying that right now. That's somewhat absent in the statute. We build in protections on the disability and make sure that the more generous, if I can use that word, disability provisions only apply if they're injured in the line of duty as defined by firefighting duty or training activities, but non-related. They wouldn't qualify for that. They are not volunteers. They're already in the coordinated plan. They're not eligible to be in the volunteer because they're covered by a coordinated plan. We're simply, I think the staff points out in the memo, that pensions are there to recruit and retain, and we want this tool to try and recruit and retain from those city workers because they're a captive audience. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll conclude my testimony. And
okay, I think the 105, as I understand it, there's some of the staff suggestions here are ones that are viewed as pretty good ones.
Mr. Chairman.
So Bedsell moves the 105.
Yes,
sir. Discussion, real quick. Mr. Martin.
Members, the thrust of the 105 amendment is that the bill specifies one way to be certified as a firefighter, and this broadens it to comparable firefighting certifying entities.
Discussion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. 106. Bedsold moves 106.
Members, I think what actually, instead of 106, there's a dash 226 amendment that
okay.
just passed out.
Bedsell moves 226.
The problem was that apparently the National Registration Board isn't exactly the one that does the EMT licensing, but the Emergency Services Regulatory Board does, and that's what's referenced in the 226.
On the
Mr. Zickman might have some comment.
Mr. Zickman.
Mr. Chairman, members, we support that.
On the Bedsell motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. 107, Senator Bedsell moves. Mr. Merton.
Members, in looking at the various requirements in the bill, it seemed to us that there was some of the later requirements were either duplicated or contradicted one of the earlier requirements. I don't know if Mr. Zickman has had a chance to take a look at that and what he thinks.
Okay.
I think it's more of a question of drafting.
Okay, on the 107, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion adopted. 108, Bedsell moves.
I don't think they want.
Don't like 108? Prohibits?
Mr. Chairman,
why
members,
wouldn't you want to prohibit this?
Right, the 108 in terms of the policy of not allowing individuals to get two pensions for the same service, we support that. I believe the way it's drafted would prohibit that concurrent pension. If I have one of those individuals that does come back nights and weekends, the way I read that amendment, that would then prohibit them. That's going on all over the state. Senator Larson's fire chief in Fergus Falls is also in the volunteer pension. Senator Michelle's fire chief is in the, but not for the same service during the day. There will be some of those individuals that do also live in the community and have been on the volunteer force for a number of years and would want to continue that service. The way I read the amendment.
Ms. Vanek, have you had a chance to review the amendment and in the bill is as described by Mr. Zickman, as you think the bill does cover the situation of double coverage for like time?
Mr. Chair, we believe that we already have a process in place to prevent double coverage for the same time.
Okay. And then I don't think 9 and 10 are going to be offered, but staff wants us to be cognizant of a couple broader issues here. 109, Mr. Martin.
Members, 109, in looking at the PERA police and fire statute, it's fairly specific on who is a police officer, but more nebulous on who is a firefighter. So this is a first attempt, perhaps, at trying to craft language that more generically describes what a firefighter is. It's broader than the bill, but we raise it just to keep the issue alive before interested parties. 110 is a similar sort of issue. Remember last session, there was considerable work by PERA police and fire and then the pension commission on making some revisions in the PERA police and fire disability program in response to some perceived coverage or benefit abuses in that program.
More than perceived.
It was our understanding that more work was going to be done on that, but I don't. There's no result from that work that's been presented to the pension commission yet this year. So this is also attempting to just keep that issue alive.
Ms. Vanek, are you still talking about that issue internally?
Mr. Chair and members, we are still talking. We have a case before the Court of Appeals, and Senator Bedsell advised me that we should wait to see the results of that and then bring forward any suggestions we have for changes.
So you're on top of it.
Yes. And Mr. Chair, I should advise you and the commission members, there are other cities that are kind of monitoring this because they have similar situations where they are short of volunteer firefighters and they're looking to full-time or city employees and so forth to be able to fill in the ranks. So just keep in mind that, you know, we may have other cities down the road that may be looking at this model.
Ms. Vanek, you're not overly thrilled with this piece of legislation? Or?
Mr. Chair and members, the Board of Trustees does not support this bill. They are very sympathetic to the issue. They think it's very creative, but they are concerned about opening up police and fire coverage to individuals whose primary work, the majority of their work throughout the day, will be non-firefighting activities. They expressed a desire to go back to the table and come up with another solution.
Senator Bedsell, why don't we think about this some more?
That's fine.
I'm not,
yeah.
You know, not necessarily
It is not
going with Ms. Vanek's argument, but I think we ought to, I think she raised a legitimate point here, and we ought to maybe just move a little slower on this one.
There are concerns.
It's in the shape you want it now.
Yes.
So let's just, we'll be back next week. So what would you do if you couldn't come here, Mr. Zickman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was supposed to be in Green Bay at a conference today, and next week I'm supposed to be in Indianapolis at a conference, but I'd rather be here.
Well, just check with my office. We may not be meeting the day that you're in Indianapolis. So, and we saved you from Green Bay. So, okay. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll set that aside temporarily, members. Then that we've put together now. Thank you very much. Where we're at for the committee next week, someone's going to meet the deadline. I guess the House is going to proceed. I don't know if we have a Senate.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think we have to get both bills through a Senate committee and a House committee on the same day because the policy committee will stop after next week. So if we can just get something through, but then they'll go to the Ways and Means.
Okay,
and
so we'll get them through the committee deadline next week, and then we'll either meet next week or the week after to take up some more of these issues that are – We will be moving into submissions that are a little more complicated. So, and we'll take up the ones that I know members want to take up. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry I was a little late. We have number one on the.
We didn't handle that today.
Pardon?
We didn't do number one today.
Okay, we'll do that next week. Then.
Later. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr.
Is that the one you kind of don't want to do, or you're okay with it, or I forgot?
I'm okay with it.
Oh, okay. I think it's in pretty good shape now. But. Yep. Represent.
You're, by next week, you mean like Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday?
Whenever the, yeah, not Monday. That is a deadline day Tuesday?
Yeah.
Don't we have to kind of let people get through their deadlines? And
right.
So, okay, thank you, everybody. Meeting adjourned.